prison to Askalan. He was then transferred to Soroka Hospital after his health deteriorated. The Prisoner Society held Israel responsible for Amor's death because of the deliberate medical negligence and inappropriate detention conditions.
Medical treatment is among the basic rights of each man according to all international laws. Many Palestinian prisoners have died because of medical negligence. Omar was suffering from serious deteriorated health conditions. Israeli prison authorities knew that he was in pain and had heart problems, but they never provided him with even medical examinations. It was a slow killing policy that Israel used against Omar and is now using against other prisoners as well.
227 Palestinian prisoners have died in Israeli jails and detention centers since 1967. Hundreds of other prisoners have lost their lives shortly after their release. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the main reason for the deaths of majority of those prisoners was lack of medical care.
Omar is the latest victim of Israel's deliberate medical negligence. This is one of the most prominent systematic policies that have killed many prisoners in Israeli jails. Since 1967, 227 prisoners have died behind bars. Israel continues its policies and crimes amid the international silence.
According to a statement by the Prisoners' Society, some 5,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Some 550 of the detainees suffer from very difficult health conditions due to chronic diseases and inhumane Israeli policy concerning their treatment. The death of Sami Amor sheds light on the suffering of hundreds of sick prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian prisoners' organizations call for an immediate international intervention to save the lives of these prisoners. They also warn that Israeli jails might turn into graves for severely ill detainees, as Israel insists on keeping them behind bars without offering appropriate medical care. Muna Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Yemen's Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and Children has held an event in the capital Sana'a to mark the International Day for Children's Rights. The local body released a report highlighting the tragic situation of Yemeni children amid the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade for the course from March 2015 to November 2021.
For 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition, with the support of the United States, has been carrying out airstrikes and killing Yemeni children. This is a flagrant violation of international law that guarantees the protection of children during conflicts and wars. The Saudi-led coalition seeks to destroy the future of the Yemeni people by targeting educational facilities and depriving the children of their basic rights. These children are the basic foundation for building a new Yemen when the war ends.
The report says 300 Yemeni children die every day due to the lack of health services. The number of children suffering from cancerous tumors has also reached 71,000 as a result of the Saudi-led coalition's use of internationally prohibited weapons in bombing residential areas.
There is injustice and grave violation of rights against the Yemeni children. On top of them, it is the right to live. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has targeted schools and disrupted the educational process. The right to access healthcare also does not exist amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport and the lack of necessary medicines. When we talk about children's rights in Yemen, we feel pain, and only those who experienced it will feel this pain. The children of Yemen celebrate International Day for Children's Rights because it gives them hope despite their stolen rights.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children, and displaced millions more.
Yemenis say the atrocities of Saudi Arabia and the suffering of the Yemeni children are the results of the years-long war and siege imposed on the country. They believe that the UN's removal of Riyadh from the list of parties responsible for grave violations against children last year has emboldened the kingdom to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
July 14, 2015. After years of negotiations, Iran signed a deal with the US, the UK, France, Germany, China, and Russia, which put caps on Tehran's nuclear program in return for sanctions removal. The agreement was dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. At first, it seemed like there was a new era of cooperation between Iran and the West, but that optimism was soon shattered by Washington. In 2016, Donald Trump won the race to become the President of the United States. During his tenure, he adopted an increasingly hostile attitude toward Tehran. This enmity reached a peak in 2018 when Trump unilaterally pulled his country out of the Iran nuclear deal, violating an international accord and a Security Council resolution that endorsed it. He then reinstated previous sanctions on Tehran and even imposed new ones. At the same time, he threatened other parties to the deal, including its allies, with sanctions if they refused to comply with Washington's anti-Iran measures. Despite the U.S. withdrawal, Tehran declared that it would continue respecting its commitments under the agreement. That is, if the remaining parties, referred to as the P4 plus 1 group, guaranteed Iran's benefits as was promised under the JCPOA. Iran showed ample patience for the other sides to honor their end of the bargain. In fact, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in its 16 reports, confirmed Tehran's full compliance with the JCPOA until 2019. It was in May that year, and a whole year after the US withdrawal, that the country started scaling back its commitments when Britain, France, and Germany failed to keep their end of the deal. Iran's remedial measures were in line with mechanisms foreseen in the text of the JCPOA, particularly Articles 36 and 37. The country, on numerous occasions, said it would reverse those measures if the other parties respected their commitments. But after more than 3 years following Washington's unilateral pullout, Iran could not see any change on the part of the Western signatories. Ironically, the new U.S. administration under President Joe Biden persisted with its predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Between April and June this year, Tehran held talks with the P4 plus 1 group with the aim of removing the sanctions that had been illegally imposed on it. But no breakthrough was reached. Now, a new round of talks is scheduled to start on the 29th of November. Ahead of the negotiations, Iranian officials have declared that the talks must focus on the full removal of sanctions in a verifiable manner. They have also made it clear that they will not renegotiate the country's nuclear program.
As I said, these negotiations are aimed at removing the sanctions imposed by Americans through their violation of the JCPOA and Resolution 2231. We concluded nuclear negotiations in 2015, which resulted in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
Moreover, Tehran has emphasized that it will only engage in talks that lead to practical results.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
The talks between Iran and the P4 plus 1 group will start on November 29th in Vienna, and Tehran will certainly take the other side's promises with a grain of salt, considering the West's record of violating its own commitments.
Thousands of people leaving their home countries in pursuit of a better life are now trapped in appalling conditions and fighting for survival at Belarus's western border with Poland. Their dream was to enter the EU, but now they are stuck behind barbed wires, battling freezing weather and hunger. Almost a dozen of them have already died, and fears are growing for the safety of others.
It's like so many of them doesn't have food, water, they have small kids, and they're freezing, and the weather is pretty cold. That's all I have to say.
It's no good, no water, no food, no time, no life.
Mostly from Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, migrants have been stranded in a wooded area for weeks. Fed up with the dire living conditions, a group of them tried to cross into Poland on Tuesday. But Polish forces, guarding the fortified border crossing, used tear gas and water cannon to push them back.
You don't follow the orders.
That triggered some to throw stones at the border guards. The incident drawing this reaction from Moscow.
The behavior of the Polish side is completely unacceptable. I think the water cannons and tear gas and shots over the migrants' heads toward Belarus state, all of it reflects a desire to hide their own actions. And they cannot but understand that they violate all thinkable norms of the international humanitarian law and other international law norms.
The EU is accusing Belarus of engineering an unprecedented wave of migrants at Poland's border in revenge for the sanctions it's suffering from the bloc. Belarus, however, denies the allegations, accusing the EU of turning its back on the migrants and trying to shift the blame on Minsk to justify its new sanctions. Russia is backing Belarus in this dispute, with the Kremlin questioning the EU's double standards over the migrant crisis, warning that such approaches put the bloc in a bad position. The EU is now looking to widen the sanctions on Belarus. Reacting to the news of the new sanctions, President Alexander Lukashenko said Belarus does not want confrontation with bloc over the migrant crisis. Lukashenko even initiated a phone call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday to discuss his proposal to end the crisis. Considering Belarus's earlier threat to shut down Russian gas supplies to Europe via pipelines that run through its territory, its latest reaction to the EU's fresh sanctions could be interpreted as a desire for de-escalation.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Narzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More signs of a country divided. That's the reaction of many Americans after Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty on all counts. He had taken an automatic weapon to a protest, shooting and killing two people and wounding another. Many people were shocked by the verdict and say it's about white privilege, and others say justice was served. Stay with us as we look at this ever-increasing divide in the United States. I'm going to start off by crossing over to Washington, D.C., talking to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to see you. Colin, I mean, it's just so familiar. I just don't even realize how many times we've had this discussion over the years of something like this. Tell me what's being said on that side of things.
Well, a lot of people like myself, Marzia, were not surprised at this verdict. I mean, here you have a young white guy. Many people said he characterized him as a boy. He was 17 at the time of the incident, but now he's officially a man at age 18. But yet still, they, in some of the narratives that were coming from the U.S. here, they still characterized him as a boy. Of course, diminishing his accountability in the incident where he took the lives of two people and then maimed another person. And so when you look at the optics of a man who, or a boy at the time, had a gun that is intended to kill people, and goes into a protest where things are very volatile and unpredictable. One can almost expect that the outcomes may not be typically favorable with that. And then when you see someone walking away to live the rest of their life as a free man, despite having taken the lives of two people, there are a lot of people who think that a grave injustice was done here. Now, like you alluded to before, on the other side, there are those who said, well, he legally had the gun, he was allowed to be on public streets during that protest, and he was defending himself. So the jury ruled or decided in the correct direction. And that's where you see there are two schools of thought, two ideals, two understandings of the principles of America, where you can have a gun and you could exacerbate a situation. But if that situation turns on you, even though you might have been the one to instigate it, you legally have the right to defend yourself and obviously take a life without any type of reprisal. And I think that's what people are having problems dealing with as they try to process this verdict, that it was legally okay, but ethically, it was really an inhumane act that was committed by a boy who is now considered a man in American society.
I mean, what you just said, legally okay, and one would wonder if it was a black teen had done that, if it would have been legally okay. Thanks so much for that update out of D.C., Colin Campbell. I'd like to welcome our guests to the spotlight, writer and journalist Abayomi Azikiwe out of Detroit. And writer and rights activist Yane Nadako out of Philadelphia.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, we'll cross over to Philadelphia and start this off with Yane. Thanks so much again for being with us. Your overall opinion of the verdict?
Well, I think that, you know, it's nuanced, as was discussed by the previous correspondent, in that what we observed is that there was a lot of consideration for the humanity, overwhelm, bad mistakes, youth of, you know, Rittenhouse. And that's something that consistently happens, where there's a willingness to care about whomever the perpetrator may be when that perpetrator is white. And that same kind of consideration and care is generally not extended to people who are not white. And so I think that when you look at a system where you have individuals who have actually had acts of self-defense over the course of decades of people actually really truly attacking and oppressing them directly or through as members of a larger community, and those people are in prison sometimes for decades. We've got a large number of political prisoners and in the U.S. right now who are in prison for having defended themselves and protected their lives against aggressive violence in a context that we know has always been very violent. And there's very little to no no consideration given to the circumstances of what happened when people are fighting for their cases. You know, when you see repeatedly that there are these efforts that these vigilantes take on the flip side and actually establish the aggression, and then, you know, when that comes back on them, protect themselves from the aggression that they created in their engagement of the act of the conflict, they're given all of this consideration. And so it just really speaks to what, speaking of political prisoners, political prisoner from Philadelphia, Mumia Abu-Jamal, said about the law here in the United States, which is that it means whatever the white men of that time want it to mean. It's not universally applied. It's created as if it's objective, but it's not universally applied.
All right, stay with me, Yanhe. Let me get Abu-Yomi in on this discussion. Abu-Yomi, your take in general, I mean, if he was a black teenager walking in the street with an automatic weapon, then used his weapon to kill and wound, to kill two people, wound another, do you think that the court would have looked at the case in the same way? I think that's the question of the day for especially people living outside the United States who perhaps can't understand this whole situation as well. Abu-Yomi, I can't hear you. Okay, I think you're muted. I think your mic is muted. Okay, I'm going to come back to you. Hopefully we can clear this up, the technical side of things. We can get this done. I'll go back to Yanhe. Yanhe, the same question. I mean, because especially when you're talking to the international audience, a lot of times people cannot really understand racism in the United States in the way that it is. And
right.
When they see a case like this, and they're like, well, of course, perhaps then, okay, Abu-Yomi, I think I have your voice. Can you hear me?
All right. Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
So stay with me, Yanhe. I'm going to go back to Abu-Yomi. Thanks so
yes,
much.
Sir.
I'm glad we got that technical issue cleared. Did you hear the question, or should I repeat it, Abu-Yomi?
Yeah, I was saying that Tamir Rice in Cleveland several years ago was 12 years old. And he was playing with a toy gun in a public park. And a white man called 911 and said it was a child playing with a gun. It's probably harmless. Well, if it was harmless, why are you calling the police? So the dispatcher called the police and said it was a black man in the park with a gun, calling a gun. And two white police officers showed up and gunned him down within a matter of seconds. The question is almost rhetorical. This would not be the same discussion if you had a young African-American who was charged with killing two whites. And it's interesting that Rittenhouse killed two other white people and wounded a third person. One of them was Jewish. So it just goes to show even whites who are demonstrating against racism in the United States are subject to brutality, to vigilante violence. And that's just the reality that we're dealing with.
Yes, and Yanhe, I mean, we witnessed some very interesting acts during this case. I mean, such as the judge allowing him, Rittenhouse, to choose his own jury by lot. The judge said that people feel better when they are in control. It, in so many ways, it's so mind-boggling because we have seen time and time again the dehumanization process, for example, when people of color are arrested or are held on trial, put on trial, and then we see this, basically the judge talking about needing control, that person. I mean, it's so mind-boggling. Your take on, and so many, the situation that took place during this case.
Well, you know, there's a message that I hear. You know, we talk about the messaging that goes out through the actions and activities. You know, we talk about dog whistles, signals that you give. When you look at this case, you look at the case of Ahmaud Arbery, who was gunned down by two vigilante, individuals while taking a jog. There's a message that's going out. Even when you look at how Dylan Roof, the young man who went to the church and shot up, a church of people who welcomed him into the church, and how they treated him after you know, during the arrest process and en route to the prison, stopping and getting them little something to eat,
right.
There's a message that's being delivered about what you're doing and whether or not what you're doing is actually aligned with the goals of the larger establishment, and whether, therefore, it will be actually really treated punitively when they do these things. So there's a message that these people are actually aligned and deserve protection because what they did is actually fits the goals and making sure that there's a certain communities that stay in their place as it relates to this hierarchical oppressive system. So that's what I hear in that situation. And one thing I just want to mention is that we've not only had the example of Tamir Rice, who was shot down with a toy gun within seconds of being encountered by the police. We also have examples of quite a number of fully grown, clearly grown white men who have been in public places where there were crowds of people with actual definitive guns waving them and being talked down by the police instead of being shot down.
Right. Abayomi, what does this do to the psyche of African Americans in general, living this day in and day out? And of course, we understand different parts of the country perhaps is somewhat different. But in general, this type of systemic racism is part of the soul of the United States. What does it do to the psyche of people living with this day in and day out? I think that part of it is really not talked about enough.
I think that W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the double consciousness, and you have to, as a black person in North America, you have to be aware all the time, particularly when you're confronting the authorities, that you could be severely harmed or killed. And, you know, the whole book that was written in the 1960s about black rage from a psychiatric standpoint is a reality. So, yes, you do have to be extremely aware and extremely conscious about your racial identity and skin color in the United States, and also whites as well. This case illustrates clearly that if they come out in solidarity with African Americans, they could easily be killed or stigmatized for life.
It's interesting you talked about the solidarity. I want to look at the solidarity, Yane, on the other side of Rittenhouse, because the funding for his legal case, there was so much money raised for it. I mean, it sounds similar to back in St. Louis, and we saw Mike Brown being killed, and we saw the cop who did that and raised so much money for his defense. Let's talk about that divide and that side of things. That what is it, then, that will bring this type of solidarity for someone who obviously has killed people, but others feel that it's their responsibility to give them all the support that they can, even financial support?
Well, it's solidarity with the ideas of what is called white supremacy. I don't like that term because there's nothing supreme about these behaviors and actions, but that is what it is that people are taking a position on the side of, and they know that that's what they're doing. They're taking a position that what he did was heroic or necessary, and that he needs to be protected. And it's really his whiteness that I believe is drawing people to provide that kind of support and their desire to continue to perpetuate these systems that give them a feeling of having a leg up. Or the opportunity to get a leg up, and what their, for most people, it would be their whiteness would provide for them. So I perceive that as being, people are, right now we're in a country that is really asking people to choose between the side of humanity and the side of white supremacy. And so some people are making that choice, and they're making the choice on the side of white supremacy, consciously or unconsciously, because there are parts of the society that don't actually engage with a large number of the diverse parts of the population to actually know and understand what it's like, and especially in some of these urban environments and some of these under-resourced environments that don't even understand what the environment is like. And that ignorance enables them to continue to be aligned outside of their and against their class interest with this white supremacist system that continues to oppress many of those people as well.
Right. Well, Abiyomi, how do you explain what appears to be this deep disdain for black people in certain official circles in the United States, and obviously certain individuals still, even in 2021, there is a type of hatred that, again, perhaps people who haven't seen it cannot understand, that an individual that you don't even know, that you could have such deep resentment towards it. Explain this to my international audience, please.
It goes back to the period of enslavement. It was necessary for the white ruling class in the United States to demonize, to make it appear as if African people were inherently inferior. They needed to be controlled. They had to be exploited, and they had to be converted to the European belief systems. So this is the origin of it. In order to maintain that system, they had to institutionalize these theories. And then even after the Civil War and the purported liberation of African people from enslavement, in order to maintain the same system of racial hierarchy and national oppression and economic exploitation, they had to continue this myth that African people were genetically inferior to whites. And even today, in academic circles in the United States, you still have these theories that are being advanced. And it becomes even more important today because you have a rising minority that is becoming a majority. It will be a majority within perhaps 20 to 25 years, a collective majority, being black, brown, Middle Eastern, Asian, and indigenous people will be a majority collectively in the United States. So they have to reinstitute another form of Jim Crow and apartheid. That's what the whole debate is around critical race theory in the schools. Critical race theory came out of the law schools in the United States many decades ago. Yet they use it as a buzzword, as a wedge issue to justify not teaching the history of enslavement, the history of the forced removal and genocide of indigenous people, the history of the Civil War, that it was based upon whether or not the United States would be a slave system or a capitalist system, the suppression of African political rights, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, all of that. They want to suppress the teaching of this so they can rationalize or attempt to rationalize the continuation of this white supremacist system.
Yonet, we've seen protests after the verdict taking place in several cities. Can a system which has been built and has profited from racism actually change itself? And I guess the question would be, why would it change itself? I mean, these demonstrators, protesters are demanding a change in the justice system, but your take on that?
Yeah, I think that this system is not going to change itself, and I don't think that people are going to change the system unless they change it over it with a new system that's replacing it. And a lot of people are beginning to understand the imperative to actually just build something that works for everyone and not only for a small select few. And I think part of the challenge is to help people who actually do have the same material interests to be able to operate with that understanding and not be manipulated by the ways that those who are in conflict with those material interests are pitting groups against each other while continuing to keep pressure from above and below.
So what is key? Staying with you, Yannis. So what is key here?
It's going to be able to be transformed. And I think that I personally believe that it is not a good use of time to put a lot of energy into that. Certainly, I think that there are things that people need to do in order to obtain relief from the violent ways that the system itself in our communities. But what we really need is for our people thinking about what new things we can have and building something together collectively that takes care of all of the needs of the whole community.
Okay, well, Abayomi, there have been growing calls in the United States in general about secession and having the country break up in several autonomous regions. Would something like this help the racism issue in the United States? Or what do you see as key? What has to happen to change this status quo?
Yeah, the overall system has to be thrown out, and there has to be a new system instituted. And in terms of partition, you know, the issue involving the Civil War between 1861 and 1865 killed over 1 million people and dislocated many more. So it's a serious question. And we can see the seeds of a coming Civil War, another Civil War in the United States in the 21st century. How can these issues be resolved short of some type of violent explosion or conflict when you have a situation where whites can at will not only kill blacks, but kill whites who express solidarity with blacks? So it's a very serious situation.
And your take, Yannis, what do you think has to happen?
I think that it is very serious. And, you know, after the verdict, I actually received messages from people who are just expressing the fact that the work that we do on the streets now feels seems more dangerous, right? It's actually also a form of counterinsurgency to try to create an environment where people feel afraid. So we have, you know, people who are generally wanting to just be and live at peace, and then are forced to fight and protest against the lack of peace and the violence in their lives. And if they do that, there's legislation that has been passing saying that protesters can be run down by cars. They've demonstrated that people can be gunned down, that there are no protections against even your right to assert that you have rights. And so it is very complicated. There is a lot of energy and support that's being given to those who may want to attack and who demonstrate a desire to attack the communities that bear the brunt of oppression. And so at some point in time, there is going to potentially be a standoff between these communities, because at the end of the day, people are going to stand and fight for their right to be alive and to thrive in their lives. And so when people are coming and saying, whenever you try to demand something better, we're going to shoot you down, people are going to begin to be prepared for that potential conflict and confrontation, and things can begin to get much uglier, which it seems that is being driven towards actually. And so it is a very serious question that's on the table, and there's a lot of life at stake, around the world, where there's the international community that also has to deal with the different ways that imperialist white supremacist capitalist ideals are confronting communities all around the world. It's
okay,
not
I'm going to have to end it there. Unfortunately, I'm out of time, but I appreciate talking to both of you, writer and journalist Abayomi Azikiwe out of Detroit, and writer and rights activist Yannis Nadago out of Philadelphia. And as always, we appreciate you being with us, and hopefully you have enjoyed this spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
No president has ever packed as much of his agenda, domestic and foreign, into a single piece of legislation as President Biden has, with a $3.5 trillion spending plan that Democrats are trying to wrangle through Congress over the next 6 weeks. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, Biden's Entire Presidential Agenda Rests on Expansive Spending Bill. President has ever packed as much of his agenda, domestic and foreign, into a single piece of legislation as President Biden has, with a $3.5 trillion spending plan that Democrats are trying to wrangle through Congress over the next 6 weeks. The bill combines major initiatives on the economy, education, social welfare, climate change, and foreign policy, funded in large part by an extensive rewrite of the tax code, which aims to bring in trillions of dollars from corporations and the rich. That stacking of priorities has raised the stakes for a president resting his ambitions on a bill that could fail over the smallest of intra-party disputes. If successful, President Biden's far-reaching attempt could result in a presidency-defining victory that delivers on a decades-long campaign by Democrats to expand the federal government to combat social problems and spread the gains of a growing economy to workers, striking a fatal blow to the government-limiting philosophy of President Ronald Reagan that has largely defined American politics since the 1980s. But as Democrats are increasingly seeing, the sheer weight of President Biden's progressive push could cause it to collapse, leaving the party empty-handed, with the president's top priorities going unfulfilled. Some progressives fear a watered-down version of the bill could fail to deliver on the party's promises and undermine its case for a more activist government. Some moderate Democrats worry that spending too much could cost the Democrats, particularly those in more conservative districts, their seats in the 2022 midterm elections, erasing the party's control of Congress. The legislation, which Democrats are trying to pass along party lines and without Republican support, contains the bulk of Joe Biden's vision to overhaul the rules of the economy in hopes of reducing inequality and building a more vibrant middle class. But its provisions go beyond economics. Democrats hope the package will create a pathway to citizenship for as many as 8 million undocumented immigrants, making it easier for workers to form unions and lower prescription drug costs for seniors. They want to guarantee pre-kindergarten and community college for every American, bolster the nation's strategic competitiveness with China, and stake an aggressive leadership role in global efforts to fight climate change and corporate tax evasion. The plan includes a large tax cut for the poor and the middle class, efforts to reduce the cost of childcare and expand access to home health care for older and disabled Americans, and create the first federally guaranteed paid leave for American workers. It is almost as if President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had stuffed his entire New Deal into one piece of legislation, or if President Lyndon B. Johnson had done the same with his Great Society, instead of pushing through individual components over several years. The president is on the cusp of achieving a major expansion in public education, one of the largest expansions of the social safety net, the largest investment in climate change mitigation, and overhauls in labor law and drug pricing, said Patrick Gaspard, a a former Obama administration official who is now the president of the Liberal Center for American Progress in Washington. Each one of these things is significant in its individual constituent parts, he said, but taken as a whole, I think spreads to the remarkable opportunity that we have. These once-in-a-generation opportunities to set a course that creates growth for all, including and especially those who have been most vulnerable in this economy. If the effort succeeds, President Biden will have accomplished much of what he campaigned for in one fell swoop. Observers say he will carry a strengthened hand into global summits in October and November that are meant to galvanize the world around transitioning from planet-warming fossil fuels and ending the use of offshore havens that companies have long used to avoid taxation. While White House officials say the breadth of the program in the package form a unified vision for the United States' domestic economy and its place in the world, and that the planks serve as a sort of coalition glue, a something-for-everybody approach that makes it difficult to jettison pieces of the plan in negotiations, even if they prove contentious. But the sheer scope of its content has opened divisions among Democrats on multiple fronts. When Biden cannot afford to lose a single vote in the Senate and no more than 3 votes in the House of Representatives, centrists and progressives have clashed over the size of the spending in the legislation and the scale and the details of the tax increases that President Biden wants to use to help offset its costs. They're divided over prescription drug pricing, the generosity of tax credits for the poor, the aggressiveness of key measures to speed the transition to a lower-emission energy sector, and much more. Even items that are not priorities for President Biden have opened rifts. On Friday, 17th of September, one of the party's most outspoken progressives, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, took aim at a crucial priority of several top Democrats, including Senator Chuck Schumer, saying she would resist attempts to fully repeal a cap on deductions for state and local property taxes that would aid high earners in high-tax areas. If President Biden's party cannot find consensus on those issues and the bill dies, the president will have little immediate recourse to advance almost any of those priorities. Outside of a hard-fought victory on a bipartisan infrastructure package, which has passed the Senate but not yet cleared the House, President Biden has found almost no reception from Republicans for his proposals. His economic, education, and climate agendas, and perhaps even additional efforts to rebuild domestic supply chains and counter China, could be blocked by Republicans under current Senate rules for most legislation. Republicans say the breadth of the bill shows that Democrats are trying to drastically shift national policy without full debate on individual proposals. Representative Kevin Brady of Texas, the top Republican on the Ways and Means Committee, complained repeatedly this week that Republicans and conservatives believe that our government is wasting so much to kill so many American jobs. President Biden's plan would hook a whole new generation of the poor on government dependency, he said. Biden administration officials say the bill's contents are neither secret nor socialist. They say the plan tracks with the proposals that Joe Biden laid out in the 2020 presidential campaign in his first budget request and in an address to a joint session of Congress. There is a through line to everything that we're advancing, Brian Deese, who heads the White House National Economic Council, said in an interview. From investments in education to winning the clean energy economy of the future to restoring fairness to the tax code, that connects to how we make ourselves globally competitive in this next quarter of the 21st century. Ted Kaufman, a long-term aide to President Biden who helped lead his presidential transition team, said the core of the bill went back much further to a set of newsprint brochures that campaign volunteers delivered across Delaware in 1972 when Joe Biden won an upset victory for a Senate seat.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.